We're going to be talking about engagement and adherence and LAIs today, and I really love talking about antipsychotic medications. I've worked most of my career with patients who have serious mental illness, and we've come such a long way. When I finished my clinical training, we didn't have any second generation long-acting injectables yet. 1 year later, they started rolling those out, and I feel like it gives us so much hope. All right, so we'll be talking about issues with adherence with antipsychotics, including side effects, comorbidities, how our own communication as clinicians can have a big impact on this, and then, of course, the appropriate use of long-acting injectables. So today we're here to talk about medication adherence. How many of you would think it was so amazing if every patient took their medications exactly as prescribed? Wouldn't we all, right? Maybe we're inching closer to that being closer to a reality. We'll see. A non-adherence defined, of course, is just the degree to which a patient is or isn't actually carrying out the recommended or agreed upon treatment plan. Lots and lots of consequences for treatment non-adherence. First and foremost, relapse or symptom exacerbation. And then you'll see across the bottom all of the psychosocial disruptions that can happen, including ongoing conflicts with family. We've all been there, right? Patients, families, conflict constantly. We might have also potential physical health consequences, issues with quality of life. And lastly, but most economically significant, are the healthcare costs of rehospitalizations. We'll look at just a few stats to get us started. So 21% prevalence of having any mental illness in the United States, almost 6% prevalence of serious mental illness. And the usual definition, or the SAMHSA definition of that, is schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, and recurrent MDD. Non-adherence among patients with SMI is very high, but it is also in line with other chronic medical conditions. And then we estimate a general number of 50% overall non-adherent to treatment. That's a lot of our patients. And specific prevalence of non-adherence for the SMI diagnoses, schizophrenia being the highest with 50 plus, followed by depressive disorders, looking at recurrent major depression or treatment-resistant depression right at 50%, and bipolar disorders at around 35% non-adherence. Okay, so this slide looks at things a little bit differently. This was a study of patients with schizophrenia, and they used the MEMS caps. Is anyone familiar with those MEMS caps? They basically tell you when the cap of the bottle of pills is opened, and that data gets recorded. So this is a 4-week study, and the bar on the yellow is the group that was adherent per the MEMS cap data, 48%. So we're really close to that 50%. And then the blue bars show the different categories of patients who were non-adherent in chunks of 20, up to 20%, up to 40%. And what's really interesting about this is these patients knew they were being watched, observed their adherence, and were still right almost at 50% being adherent. Lots and lots of reasons for non-adherence. First and foremost, you know, the medication regimen might be really complicated. Different classes of drugs, different times of day, take this with food, take this on an empty stomach. It sometimes can be really impossible to organize that. And access to services. A pharmacy can be another barrier for patients. They might have to go pick up refills at different time periods throughout the month. They might not be able to pay for anything. I'll tell you a very quick story about a job that I used to have. In Philadelphia, I was on a research study as an interventionist, and I would go to my assigned 20 patients' houses every week, fill their pill box, order their refills, do everything we needed to do. And these patients had serious mental illness, but also HIV. So we really, really needed this medication adherence to be good, or we really were trying for that anyway. And what we found is one of the biggest barriers wasn't just taking the pills out of the box every day and having that organization set up, but the pharmacy had the refill schedule let's say they were on four medications. One week you get this refill, the next week you get that refill, maybe at the end of the month you get that refill. Even if you have it on auto setup, it just isn't logistically workable for a lot of our patients. So one of our biggest interventions was calling the pharmacy, getting all of those set on the same day per month, and they were able to work with us. But we had to figure out the ask, and then we had to negotiate with multiple pharmacies. But it really, really can help our patients take these meds. Some medications will require lab tests that patients may not want to do or may not be able to feasibly do. Lack of motivation or insight, cognitive impairment, and impulsivity can obviously disrupt your consistency in taking meds. I'll tell you one more tiny short story. I have this gentleman when I worked for visiting nurse services in New York on the mental health team. Similar to that research study, I was going into patients' homes once or twice a week, filling pill boxes, troubleshooting with getting to appointments, doing some case management, that sort of thing. And I have this one gentleman that I'll never forget. I went to his house three times a week because he'd had so many hospitalizations, but he was really very high functioning, had a job, when he could stay on his meds. And I would go in, let's say on Monday, fill the box. I get there on Wednesday, check the box, get there on Friday, check the box. And I say, so I noticed that you missed some doses on Monday and Tuesday because they're still in the box, right? Wednesday's gone, Thursday's gone, Friday's gone. And he would look at me and say, no, I didn't. Like, well, how do you explain that these 2 days worth of pills are still sitting here in this box? Oh, I'm not sure how that happened, but I took them all. You know, so lots of challenges, lots of fun. It was a great job. Okay, so also personal value judgments and lack of acceptance of illness. And we'll talk a little bit more later about patients' beliefs about their illness, patients' beliefs about medication, and how that can influence what they're actually going to take. Jonathan will spend a lot of time talking about specific side effects and other issues that might impact adherence. And then I'll spend some more time later talking about patient-provider relationships. We know that if our relationship is bad, adherence is going to follow and not be optimal. Okay, self-report. I've already illustrated a case why that is really not a good measure of adherence, right? It's just not. Even for anyone, psychotropic meds or antibiotics, anything. It's very hard for anyone to stay on track every day with all of the medications. If you're going to rely on self-report even a little bit, it's really important to get some collateral data. And that might be from a nurse working with the patient or a caregiver or someone that's designated to try to monitor what they're actually taking. Pharmacy claims data. This in theory sounds like a really good idea, but there are a lot of reasons why it doesn't always work or it doesn't work in isolation. So you can look and track refills. You can look and track medication possession ratio, which is this fancy way of looking at refills covering days and how much supply you have and are there any gaps in that. But what if you're on auto refill? What if you're on auto refill through the mail? You're getting all of these things, but it doesn't mean you're actually taking all of these things, right? We don't have the MEMS caps for everyone. And even with the MEMS cap, you can take a pill out of a bottle, put the cap back on and not swallow it. Excuse me. And I mentioned earlier how I would look at my patients in the research study pill count. I actually had to count each and every pill. But even if you miss one dose in a week, you might fall below that 80% that's the generally accepted adherence level. And I want to just say in that study, we did multiple things because we were doing a research study. We were trying to get as close to the truth as we possibly could. So we were getting self-report. We were getting pharmacy claims data. We were counting pills and doing all these things and hoping for the best. But we'll never really know what our patients were actually taking. How many of you have heard of Abilify MySight? Yeah, a few people have heard of it. Anyone prescribe this medication outside of a research study? I'm super curious. I'm seeing no hands. Okay, that's what I thought. I don't personally know anyone that's ever prescribed it. I think it's kind of fascinating, but I don't know how, you know, logistically realistic this is. So for those of you that don't know what it has a sensor in it that they call ingestible event monitor. And it communicates with the patch that you wear that has a Bluetooth technology to your phone, your smartphone that has an app. And so it's supposed to tell you exactly what time you swallowed the pill. It'll show up in your app, and you can share that with your clinician or whomever you want. And it also tracks steps and activity, as well as periods of rest. In theory, this sounds like really good data, right? But you can see what the problems might be. I'm giving a patient who might most likely have a psychotic disorder a pill to swallow that's being tracked. Lots of issues here. Seems like a really good idea. Okay, and last but certainly not least, therapeutic drug monitoring, TDM, looking at actual plasma levels of the antipsychotic medication. We've been accustomed to doing this for mood stabilizers for decades, and now we're able to get this on just about every antipsychotic medication, and really it's going to be your most objective measure of how much drug is entering the body. And I know Jonathan would agree with me on that, since he's written
absolutely.
A book about
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's talk about how attitudes and beliefs can really impact adherence, as well as side effects in general. It's really important that we have these conversations with our patients, because if they don't believe that their illness warrants medication, or they have some kind of beliefs about medication, they're not going to take the medication, or they're not going to take it as prescribed, 9 times out of 10. So what do medications mean to our patients? Pharmacotherapy has a meaning to everyone. We either buy in, we don't buy in. We're gonna say drug is panacea, it fixes everything. There's a pill for that, let's take it. Or we might say no, drugs are the enemy, I don't wanna take any kind of drugs. I don't wanna take medical drugs, I don't wanna take psychotropic drugs. Or we can be somewhere in the middle of that spectrum. So this drug attitude inventory, 10 item version, is very commonly used and not very hard to use. This is something you can hand to the patient in the lobby periodically. There's a 30 question version, but 10 is obviously more practical and reliable and valid. So the way this is scored is any of the answers that are in bold are going to indicate a person who's got an adherent attitude with drugs. The regular font will be more of a non-adherent attitude. And you get 1 point for any bold answer, so +1, and you get 1 point taken away, or -1, for any of the questions in regular font. And then your total score, if it's positive, indicates the person has adherent beliefs about drugs, adherent attitude. If your score, total score is negative, the opposite, non-adherent drug attitude. And of course, this can change over time, right? They might be adherent now or have that adherent attitude, and then something goes wrong, the drug doesn't work, or they have terrible side effects, and that might change. So it's important to check these more than one time. And this slide tries to illustrate the drug attitude inventory and what it means and where a person fits on the pharmacophobic to pharmacophilic spectrum. So on the left, the pie chart on the left, that indicates a low adherence. So you'll see high skeptical, high ambivalent, high indifferent. And if you go all the way to the right, you have the highest adherence illustration. So you can see there's still quite a bit of ambivalence, but more accepting and very little skepticism. And it turns out that skepticism belief is the biggest indicator of non-adherence. So you'll see how large that chunk is on the far left pie chart. I like pictures. All right. So super important that our patients, we're talking to them about side effects, and that we can talk to them about whether some of them are manageable. Is there something we can do about it? So before they're prescribed the meds, part of our informed consent process needs to include, these are the common side effects that you might see. These are the dangerous side effects that need to be reported, and having open discussions. If we don't ask our patients at every visit that they're having side effects, they might not tell us. They might not tell us because they're not thinking about it in that moment. They might be a bad historian. They might be embarrassed about certain types of side effects. It's up to us to actually engage and ask them, allow them to answer any questions. A strategy for looking at this and kind of tracking it more closely, because we might not see our patient for another month, 2 months, 3 months, depending on the type of setting that you're in and your patient volume, is to have somebody calling them and checking in. Call after the medication has been started for a week, for example. Are you having any side effects? Have you noticed any change? Is this medication helping you? Is it not doing anything? And then also trying to put a plan in place to help them set up, administer their meds, and then just get into a really good routine about communication. It's very important. The FIBSER is a measure of side effects. So this is another short form that you can use in visits periodically. It stands for frequency and intensity of side effects rating. And then it also has a global score of burden. And that becomes important, I'll tell you in just a moment. So you have three different sections. You have frequency, intensity, and burden of side effects. And these are ranked on a Likert scale from 0 to 6, 0 being none, 6 meaning very problematic. And so you rate this on frequency of side effects, how often they're occurring, intensity of side effects, how severe they are, and lastly, burden. And this is the score that actually directs you to do something different. So if you have a score of 1 to 2, you just kind of monitor that on the burden subscale. 2 to 3, you want to strategize about how you might manage the side effects. And 5 to 6, you might actually consider changing the medication. So very practical, this scale. And I will now turn it over to Jonathan, who will talk to you about some of the things, the barriers, the ideas of why adherence isn't consistent, as well as comorbidities.
Thank you very much. I do want to say, for those of you who don't know, this is Dr. Rowland's first time presenting at NEI. Is that right?
It is.
And we dragged her.
Sitting out there.
We dragged her from a long distance. How far did you travel to get here?
About 10 miles.
10 miles, exactly. So I don't know if you saw her affiliation. She's a professor at UT Austin, a very well-regarded doctorate, nurse practitioner, clinician, educator, mom, I don't know, other stuff, other good things. We've already talked about, really, some of the issues with adverse effects, and we're going to get into reasons why people may not take meds. We'll talk about adverse effects in a second, but there's other aspects of the disorder itself which really can contribute to this. I know it's shocking when you hear that non-adherence is 50%. Who would have thought? I know, my patients always take their oral meds. Yours might not, but substance use disorders increase non-adherence. Again, shocking, is it? Oh, I thought this guy using meth was always taking his meds, always. But it's important to recognize that. I think we know that. But some of the others people, I don't think, always appreciate. Depression is a big one. I actually have created lectures just on depression and schizophrenia. I think it's not something which is talked about enough. It's a highly prevalent problem, as you'll hear. And with reference to what we're talking about here, clearly impacts adherence. You go to the diabetes clinic, you get people who are depressed, you put them on antidepressants, and their A1C goes down. Well, why is that? I don't think sertraline lowers your blood sugar, but it takes depressed people who are non-adherent and it makes them adherent. Not surprisingly, patients with schizophrenia have a cognitive disorder, and separately, obesity. Yes, sometimes obesity is a side effect. It could simply be something which happens as part of the complication of having a disorder, or maybe you don't have the best diet and you're not so active. This is something, again, I don't think people talk about a lot, but I really want to emphasize to understand and appreciate both the persistence and severity of the problem. It is state dependent to some extent. If you look at somebody coming into an acute setting, who here sees acute patients on an inpatient unit? About 80% might technically meet criteria for major depression. Now, not surprisingly, we treat them with an antipsychotic, and for about half of those folks, the depression gets better. It's not that all of our antipsychotics are antidepressants, it's that being acutely psychotic bums people out and they're depressed. You treat their acute psychosis, their depression gets better. But chronically, 40%, at least 30% will have persistent moderate to severe depressive symptoms. It's really part and parcel of having schizophrenia. It's also a part of when people get worse. Yes, as you start to relapse, often some of the prodromal symptoms might be either anxiety or depression. And this is important when you're dealing with outpatients to find what are those things which predict a relapse. For some people, it can be, I'm just not sleeping as well. Other folks will say, well, a certain voice gets worse. Other people will be, you know, I just don't feel good. I feel anxious or I feel depressed. And family members are often the ones who actually see this. And there's studies that show first episode patients, 70% of family, 75% noted depressive symptoms in the prodromal period. And the patients themselves noted this. And often positive symptom increases as part of this as well. Should we treat depression and schizophrenia? Well, the answer is yes. This slide doesn't say it, but I'm gonna say it now. Hey, guess what? If their positive symptoms aren't controlled, you probably ought to go there first. That's rule number one. But for many of our patients, their positive symptoms are not the issue. They're at a low level, they're not causing functional impairment. And then the next step is, should we treat their depression? Yes, you should, absolutely. We will talk about a little bit whether they are schizophrenia versus schizoaffective bipolar type. I think the important aspect is if you have a bipolar diathesis, you're not going to give them traditional antidepressants. You will go to other molecules which work for bipolar depression. Lumateperone, lurasidone, cariprazine, etc. The quality of the data in this area is not great, and that's a little bit unfortunate. So if you read the conclusion bullet, which you've already read, it says antidepressants may be effective. You think, well, that sounds a little wishy-washy. It does, because the quality of the data is not great. I think we feel like the data in general say antidepressants make depression better in patients with schizophrenia. We wish we had somewhat better trials. Importantly, though, if you're dealing with a first episode population, you have to be very sensitive to any symptoms of depression, because this is the group with the highest suicide rate by far and away. Those first 5 years after your diagnosis is your highest suicide rate in patients with schizophrenia. So the data I show here, I love this study. 2,500 people from Finland. We think human beings in Finland are very similar to those in the United States, very similar. Followed for 4 years, the use of antidepressants in this first episode population reduced suicide mortality sevenfold by 85%. The flip side of that, if you give these first episode patients benzodiazepines chronically, you increase their risk for completed suicide almost fourfold. Nowadays, less is considered acceptable to have people on chronic anticholinergics, right? Because they cause cognitive impairment. For benzodiazepines, they also cause cognitive impairment, and we're now recognizing they increase suicide risk with really not a lot of upside in terms of improving the symptoms of schizophrenia. I mentioned obesity is one of those factors which interferes with adherence. This is data from Peter Wyden, published now over 15 years ago, showing as BMI goes up, rates of adherence go down. Now, some of this may be a reaction to a medication-related adverse effect, but there may be other factors which play a role in this association between BMI and non-adherence. This is a survey which I'd love to present. I think many of you who've gone to CME conferences have probably seen this. This is a survey of outpatients with chronic schizophrenia, large sample size, 876, just looking at the frequency of stuff. And we talk about monitoring certain things like metabolic parameters, but I can tell you, I don't have a lot of patients who come and say, I'm really worried about my glucose. Some do. But these are the things that people report as their adverse effects. Importantly, what really bums them out are certain types of adverse effects. You can see weight gain, number one, not surprising why this might be associated with non-adherence, and sexual dysfunction, number two. Sexual dysfunction is often the thing which is never talked about, sadly. And at the end of this section, I'm going to give you a checklist for adverse effects. Often people don't talk about certain things for a variety of reasons, even folks without severe mental illness. How many people have had somebody on an SSRI for months or years, and finally they tell you, oh yeah, I've had anorgasmia and I hadn't been taking it. It's because perhaps they never felt comfortable talking about it, which is not necessarily your fault. For a variety of reasons, people don't feel comfortable talking about certain subjects. Prior providers weren't interested, and maybe they learned, well, I shouldn't be talking about this stuff. You have to ask. If you don't ask, people often don't volunteer. This is something interesting now. I talked about why obesity might interfere with adherence. Okay, obviously, if I'm gaining weight on a medicine, maybe I'll skip doses. I think we can all accept that. Not a big insight there. But when you're becoming obese, you have a systemic issue, and it's often inflammation. And then there's other complications, such as developing metabolic syndrome, cardiometabolic illness, hypertension. And guess what? All of those have adverse CNS impact. Having hypertension, not improving your vascular circulation, in case you had no idea. It doesn't make it better. Having cardiometabolic illness also is a microvascular disorder. It's also an inflammatory problem, all of which are associated with worse cognition. So you can see there's really a cluster of things which go together which can impact adherence, either indirect by the patient saying, I don't want to take the med because I'm gaining weight, for example, or a more direct biological effect on CNS function, which may interfere with their adherence for cognitive reasons. Going back to that survey, you know, all those clusters of symptoms that people reported, again, nobody complains of glucose. It doesn't matter what it is. If they notice it, they don't like it, and it's a reason why they're not gonna take their medications. Doesn't matter if it's EPS or agitation, it doesn't matter if it's a CNS problem like sedation or cognitive adverse effects, endocrine adverse effects, or even metabolic, it doesn't matter. People don't like any of it. And that's why as you're trying to develop alliance, which Don will talk about next, and trying to engage people, you have to really ask people. This is a study which I also love to present because I think it's really sad in a way. This was 208 inpatients prescribed an antipsychotic for at least 2 weeks, and they were now asked to have their side effects assessed systematically. Guess what? 71.5% said they had not reported side effects to their clinician prior to that specific assessment. Okay, more than two-thirds. Well, why is that? Occasionally, not you, other clinicians are really busy and we forget to ask occasionally. Not me, of course, other clinicians. And we have people who are really ill. You know, they're not thinking clearly, they're tired, whatever. They forget to talk about it. But let's face it, let's cut people some slack. Who here has gone to a medical appointment saying, I need to ask about this? Then they come out an hour later and say, shit, I forgot to talk about that. It happens, it happens. People forget, they're stressed, whatever. It happens. The point being is people had all these things which they had forgotten to talk about. You think, well, if you're really tired, I have a dry mouth, I think I'll talk about this. If I have sexual dysfunction, people forget, or the clinician's busy, or there's kind of, you know, this sense of, well, I don't want to bother the clinician because he or she is busy. You know, there's a whole reason why people don't talk about this stuff. Plus, they're really ill, they're on an inpatient unit, they got cognitive problems, they're hallucinating, whatever. The point being is you got to ask. If you want people to trust you, if you want to develop some kind of rapport, you have to ask, because people will forget, or occasionally you might be busy and forget yourself. I like this checklist. I'm not saying you have to use this, but it's a way to kind of go through, especially when you have people who are new to you, who you don't have rapport with, you're trying to develop some type of rapport, go through it systematically. For one thing, the fact that you've done it, they'd be like, wow, no one's ever been this systematic about asking me about my side effects. And you'll cover areas which maybe were never talked about, like erectile dysfunction, dysmenorrhea. You'd be surprised how many women have a galactorrhea and don't report it. I would think this would freak you out. Folks don't talk about it for a variety of reasons. They're embarrassed, they don't know what to do, whatever. If you ask, people know you care, you're interested. These are things which is okay to talk about. What the idea is, maybe as we're making some decisions about medications, this can be a win-win proposition. We can come to, as they say, a shared decision where everyone's kind of happy. You tell me what's been bugging you about your meds, now I know. I can try to give you my input at what I think will be helpful for you, try to mitigate some of those concerns you have, and maybe this whole thing will work out much better than it did before, because guess what, you're in the hospital right now. So at that point, I'm gonna pass the baton back to Donna, and she's gonna take it away.
Thank you. Okay, so now we'll get back to talking about engagement through therapeutic alliance. Lots of ways that we can engage our patients, and we should be doing all of these things if possible. So therapeutic alliance, I'll come back to in just a moment, but also supportive psychotherapy. So if we can have a visit, let's say we're an outpatient facility, if your facility logistics will work with this, that's not a 15-minute quick med check, you can also include some supportive psychotherapy at your med visits. And talking about the beliefs and the side effects and all of the things, and spending more time. Family involvement is key, we'll come back to that. And lastly, shared decision making. So therapeutic alliance, we all know what this is. But I can't overemphasize how important this is, and I'll show you some statistics. It really is important for patients to be a good fit with us, and they have to trust us. They have to trust us in conversations as humans, that we care about them, and they also need to trust in our knowledge and that the recommendations that we're making to them are sound. And our having that therapeutic alliance does become motivation for our patients to want to adhere to the treatment plan that we work out together. Alliance equals adherence, statistically. So there was a study of 95 stable outpatients with schizophrenia, and they used that drug attitude inventory that I showed you earlier. And the only correlation that was a high level was the therapeutic alliance. It had a large correlation with a positive drug attitude leaning toward that adherence side. There were other factors that had small correlations with positive drug attitude, and that included the things here listed as older age, longer duration of illness, medical comorbidities, less stigma, higher levels of insight and functioning, and less depressive and positive symptoms. So again, alliance statistically equals adherence, and we really, really need to work on developing rapport with our patients. It matters a lot. And we can use the supportive psychotherapy that I mentioned. If that's not feasible, then getting our patients connected to standalone separate psychotherapy that can be individual, group, or involving the family. National Alliance on Mental Illness, or NAMI, you probably all are very familiar with, but they can really help families engage, especially families with a new diagnosis of a serious mental illness. They have classes and workshops, and they can also provide lots of resources. And peer support specialists, not necessarily family, but additional people around our patients to help encourage them and to help them problem solve through their journey. So I've said this a few times, so it means it's very important. This relationship is a really serious underpinning to helping our patients succeed, feel better, and be adherent. There are a lot of barriers, and we've talked about these a little bit, insight, communication, and our own attitudes. Have you ever thought about or hesitated to make a recommendation, let's say for an LAI, and your own biases and your own beliefs might have gotten in the way? I heard Carmen mention earlier about trauma and injections in certain sites. We might think, let's say I worked in inpatient psych or state hospital level of care for 20 years and shots used to be viewed as punitive, right? It's a crisis, it's a code. And we might have that belief ourselves. There have been some other qualitative studies that have looked at attitudes and beliefs of clinicians around LAIs. And one of the biggest issues is, what are your colleagues doing? If your colleagues in your practice are not prescribing LAIs, you aren't either, at least per this study. So we have to think about ourselves being a potential barrier. Shared decision-making. This is always a risk-benefit assessment. We want to be very clear with our patients in the discussion. What are the symptoms that we're targeting? And then get the information from them or from collateral sources or charts about their history, their response to medications, any side effects they've experienced, other reactions. What is their past adherence like? Do they have comorbidities or metabolic risks like Jonathan was talking about, and that might sway which medications we choose for them. So this process is a shared approach with our patient. So we're going to take our expertise, we're going to take their expertise, and we're going to come up with a patient-centered plan together. And evidence-based medicine really is the basis for this. That's our knowledge. These are the recommendations that we're going to make. But then we're going to communicate well with our patients in that therapeutic alliance that we've been building, but it's so important. Come to a shared decision, and that's going to optimize the care of our patients. This slide is a little bit busy. I just want to point out a couple things, and I'll go kind of from the bottom. And this is a model for shared decision making for adults with SMI. The relationship, 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 right? And then you're going to kind of go back and forth. It's an iterative process to get that communication and those decisions made. And that information sharing box on the bottom left is kind of that psychoed and things that we need to talk about, informed consent, all of those things. But the actual shared decision making process involves not only verbally discussing those things with our patients, but giving them visual aids, giving them things in writing. How many times have any of you gone to see one of your own clinicians? They tell you 10 things while you're there, you remember one, right? If they don't give it to you on a piece of paper, you're not going to retain it, and you're not going to be able to consider their recommendations. And I won't belabor the psycho-ed. I think I've already said all of this. Some ways that we can help our patients with becoming or being adherent with oral medications are the pill boxes that I've mentioned, or automatic dispensers if you have access to those fancy versions. Timers. Timers are good. Smartphones, watches, whatever they need and whatever they prefer. A monitoring system. And that doesn't necessarily have to be Abilify MySight. It can simply be an app that says, your meds are due at 12. Have you taken your meds? Yes or no? Something very simple. And then weekly call reminders from a caregiver or some clinician can be very helpful. Checking in, seeing how adherence is going, troubleshooting. And the antipsychotic medication decision should be a shared decision. Considering their insight, really, really eliciting their concerns and their caregiver's concerns, what the support is that they actually have, what is the likelihood that they can actually be adherent to the meds, and then back to their values and goals, really understanding their beliefs about their illness, their beliefs about medications, and what are their actual goals. What is important to them? Is it just avoidance of side effects? Is it convenience? Have they had adherence issues in the past? And lastly, if they are treatment resistant, have they been offered clozapine? And in summary, shared decision making, we really need to use this process, and we build up our therapeutic alliance to get to this patient-centered process. It's evidence-based, and it's really promising. Gone are the days of paternalistic recommendations, right? Hopefully we're not doing that. None of us in this room are doing that. And this process can help us to overcome any barriers. And then this is a nice segue into consideration of long-acting injectables. And I'll turn it back over to Jonathan.
Thank you. So before I get into this, how many people saw the Jeopardy segment yesterday? Of course, I was the winner despite rampant cheating by by Team Cutler. But at the end, we did have some free time. And you heard us, I think, give a pretty in-depth discussion in many ways about the values of LAIs. And if there's any take-home message from this segment and really from this talk about optimizing care and reacting to the issues related to non-adherence, it's that learn how to use LAIs, and these are now first-line treatments. If you're not offering them to your first episode patients, you're really doing them a disservice. And I'm going to reiterate that in several ways, but in case you had any doubts, non-adherence begins with the beginning of the diagnosis. In case any of you are going to go out and hit the town tonight, have a few tequila shots, end up at the tattoo parlor, put this on your left forearm. Adherence is dynamic, not static. Right here. Yes, we would like all of our patients to be like number one, but it ain't so. And that's why you have to find ways to monitor adherence if people are on oral meds, and why every patient should be engaged in a discussion about LAIs. Now, sometimes it's not appropriate, and I'll agree. If, as Anna said, they're treatment resistant, they need clozapine, whether there's no LAI version of that. But don't assume anything based upon the past history. You just don't know what's going on with your patient right now. She may be in a different phase of her life. Her illness may have different stressors. And while she may have looked like number one, she's now become number two. It is not static. Adherence is dynamic. It changes. And that's why you want to monitor an ongoing basis. But even better, take the whole issue out of the equation by getting this person on an LAI if you can. To drive home the point again, non-adherence begins with day one of the diagnosis of schizophrenia. It's just part and parcel of any chronic disorder. And one of the things which I was so happy that Dr. Stahl talked about yesterday, and in case you didn't hear it, was that non-adherence not only has all the psychosocial consequences, which were mentioned in the first talk, but we think it also has increased risk for hospitalization, which is obvious, but also a disease-modifying effect. it's no longer okay to say, well, maybe they relapse a couple of times, we'll talk to them about LAI. Well, guess what? I'm gonna show you data. Even after one relapse, you've already done something to their brain, and it ain't good. And we think relapse is one of the reasons why people eventually become treatment resistant. We have done something to their brain by that acute psychotic episode, which is not necessarily reversible or recoverable. This is the study I like to show more so than anything. This is a group of people from a large first episode program in Toronto at KMH, a very well-known academic but community-based psychiatric program. So here we have 130 people, mean age 22, early on in their diagnosis, who were started on an oral first generation, responded to it, were then non-adherent, and were placed back on the exact same medication, all right? Everything should be hunky-dory. Well, guess what? It wasn't. If you look just at the bottom, before I even get to the punchline, you can see that the olanzapine dose equivalents, they chose olanzapine dose equivalents for their own reasons, but already we're having to give these people 5% more drug in their second episode, okay? Why? It's the same thing, same person, right? No longer the same brain. And this is the punchline. This is the thing that should scare you straight. If you haven't been talking to first episode people about LAIs, this should convince you. This shows you the proportion of people who got 50% or more symptom reduction from their antipsychotic, okay? A pretty robust response. The first episode are the darker bars. You can see it shows you over time a large fraction of people got 50% symptom reduction. That's great. First episode people often respond really well, and these people were responders, right? That's why they were included in this analysis. But look at the light gray bars. Even when you follow them out to a year, the proportion of people who are getting the same level of symptom reduction is a fraction of what it was in their first episode. And this is after just one time non-adherence. And I think this, more than anything, should really convince you, if you haven't been talking to first episode people about LAIs, to get good at it. And it's not a one-time discussion, as the whole aspect of shared decision-making is, you find out their values, you give them their input, maybe at one point they'll say, not now, but that doesn't mean forever, and you keep bringing it up. The point being, it not only has a modifying effect, but you can tell them, you're gonna do better. You'll have lower hospitalization rates. So here's a study right here, also from Finland, retrospective after a first episode. Any depot had 1/3 the risk of hospitalization versus the equivalent all. 1/3 the risk, 36%. Most importantly, people will accept a long-acting injectable even in their first episode. So this group is from UCLA. They do a lot of these studies. They took people early on in their diagnosis, within 2 years of the onset of their illness. They enrolled them in a study where they said, we're gonna randomly assign you, if you agree to begin, we're gonna randomly assign you to the oral or LAI version of risperidone, which at that time was risperidone microspheres. But if you get randomized to the LAI arm, at any time you can opt out. You say, yeah, I changed my mind, just stick me back in the oral arm. Fine. Guess what? 93% of those randomized to the LAI stuck with it. So the idea is, oh, people don't want shots, whatever. That's often your stuff, to be honest. It's not their stuff. For a lot of these people, they like it, it's convenient, they're not reminded on their daily basis of their illness. Don't assume anything. And most importantly, hospitalization rates much, much higher in the oral risperidone group, relapse rates much lower in the LAI group. This study, the prelapse study, is a more recent study and a much larger study. These were people age 18 to 35, within 5 years of the onset of their schizophrenia, were asked to be in a study where they said, we're gonna randomize you to LAI aripiprazole, the monthly version aripiprazole monohydrate, which was the first version of that, versus usual care clinician's choice. Among the people they screened, 57% were willing to accept an LAI, 57%. Remember that number, 57%. Only 14% said, I'm not gonna be in this because I don't want an LAI. People had other reasons for declining to be in the study. You know, 29% were a lot of other reasons. But 57% said, yeah, absolutely, I'll take the LAI. And only 14%, so 1/4 of that number said, I will not accept an LAI. So we have a couple of numbers from the UCLA group of 7% refusal, here 14%. I like those odds. Not that I have a gambling problem, although I do live a mile from the Del Mar racetrack in San Diego. Haven't been there a couple of months. I'll bet you can stop. Well, anyhow. But you have to give me odds, though. But the point being is these people will accept an LAI in their first episode. And in this study, 57% said yes, and only 14% said no. And the outcome, surprisingly, people on LAIs, longer time to hospitalization, lower relapse rates. I don't think I need to say this again. You know what LAIs do for people. You just have to have the discussion so they are aware that they exist, they're aware of the options, they're aware of the convenience, and all the benefits which accrue from that. Lastly, in case you didn't get the point, first episode people are willing to consider it. Have the discussion. We have all these options now. 1 month, 2 month, 3 month, there's even a 6 month out there. For a lot of people, it's the convenience. So it's not punitive as it used to be. It's not punitive, it's liberating. Hey, I don't have to take daily pills. That's great. I don't have to be reminded of my illness on a daily basis. I don't have to fight with my family if I'm living at home about whether I took my pills or not. Lower relapse rates, lower hospitalization rates, and most importantly, you're preserving as much of their brain as you're able to do within your limits. Okay? That's all you can do. All you can do is saying, I've done everything in my power to minimize non-adherence with the most evidence-based option, which is an LAI, because I know it's not always about me, even though I have great adherence, and I'm sure all of Donna's patients take their meds all the time, right? All the time. But occasionally other people's patients don't, not mine, other people's patients. Point being, any chronic illness, non-adherence is rampant. You gotta do what you can to try to minimize that problem because it exists in the world of chronic illness.